I'm Dr. Megan Corrado, and welcome to Real Stories, a podcast that features the narratives of trauma survivors, professionals, and community leaders. Real Stories provides a platform for guests with diverse life experiences to voice and honor their unique narratives. During today's episode, we will be speaking with Dr. Scott Giacomucci. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for the invite, Megan. I'm excited to be with you and the listeners today.
Thank you. So let's start off by you telling us about who you are.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a doctor of social work. I'm a board certified psychodramatist and clinical social worker, licensed in Pennsylvania. I'm also a fellow of the American Academy of Experts in Traumatic Stress and an experiential therapy trainer. And then I'm also an author, researcher, a writer. So I have lots of different roles professionally. As you know, I'm also an adjunct professor at Bryn Mawr College in the social work school.
How do you find the time to do all of these things?
Well, the most liberating realization I had in my professional development was that I didn't have to do the same thing 40 hours a week, that I could have a lot of meaningful part-time roles. And I joke with people and tell them that because both of my parents are engineers, I'm very good with efficiency, making people fit together and overlap in a good way.
Sounds like an art.
Yeah, I guess it's part of it is art, part of it is science and logistics. That's for sure.
Can you tell us about what you do? You've already mentioned some of the roles that you play, but if you want to go into detail about any of those particular roles.
Yeah. So I'm the director and founder of the Phoenix Center for Experiential Trauma Therapy in Media in Westchester, Pennsylvania, which is an outpatient trauma therapy center. So in my role there, I do trauma therapy with clients, supervise other trauma therapists, and provide a lot of training and education. And then I'm also the director of trauma services at Miremont Treatment Center, the inpatient drug and alcohol unit, where basically I run a lot of experiential groups for clients who are in inpatient treatment.
Can you tell us what you mean by experiential?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I say experiential, I think of experiential therapy as kind of a larger umbrella term for any kind of therapy that goes beyond talk therapy. So that would include art therapy, music therapy, poetry therapy, psychodrama, sociometry, gestalt therapy, anything that goes beyond just sitting and talking. And the two primary experiential therapies that I practice and teach are psychodrama, which is primarily used in group settings. And it's, I hesitate to call it role-playing because it's not role-playing like you normally think of role-playing, but it uses role-playing techniques to explore different parts of ourselves or to explore our experience in relationships. So, for example, in psychodrama, rather than talking about somebody who passed away, I might ask a client to choose someone in the room to play the role of someone they love that passed away. And have a conversation directly with that person as if they're here in the room. So it can be a bit more involved in terms of movement and emotions. It can be a really powerful tool. I'm constantly amazed at where we can go on the psychodrama stage that maybe wouldn't have been possible otherwise. I'll talk more about that throughout the podcast too. It's really my passion.
That's amazing. So we know that every individual, every community, every system has a story, and every story includes both adversity and strength. Can you talk to us about some of the adversities that you faced?
Yeah. I mean, I think like most of us in the field, I was really attracted to being a social worker, being a therapist because of my own personal experiences. Mm-hmm. I mean, I grew up in a pretty privileged family in a suburb of Philadelphia, though I also experienced my own struggles, especially as a teenager, with addictions, with mental health, with death and loss. Mm-hmm. At this point, I've been in recovery from addiction for almost 12 years. Mm-hmm. So that was a big part of what kind of led me to wanting to be a therapist. I was introduced to psychodrama when I was 15, and I just found it amazingly powerful and helpful in terms of working through my own traumatic losses, my own emotions, mm-hmm. and trying to make sense of the world and, mm-hmm. and dealing with, you know, normal social issues.
Mm. So it sounds like you not only have a professional interest in psychodrama and experiential therapies, but you've also been able to experience some of the benefits of it even at an early age.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like as therapists, our most useful and powerful tool is ourself. And I really think it's important that we're doing our own personal work mm-hmm. or have had our own personal experiences with the types of therapies that we're practicing.
Right.
I mean, I don't always share the details of my past with clients, but there's I think there's like an existential knowing that comes through, maybe consciously, but often unconsciously, just being able to be with someone in mm-hmm. their pain, their loss, their trauma.
Right. Right. It also takes the connections that we build with our clients to another level.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of my losses and trauma that I experienced as a teenager, I really made sense of them later by becoming a therapist and helping others work through either what I had experienced or what people I loved had experienced. One of my closest friends died of an overdose when I was 17 or 18. Mm. And prior to his death, we made a commitment together that we were going to go to school, put in the work to get graduate degrees and become therapists to help mm-hmm. others like us. Mm. And, you know, he passed away. I guess it's been 10 years already. Well, so when I opened up my private practice in 2015, the original name to my practice was in honor of him. And it was mm-hmm. kind of my way of fulfilling my end of the agreement and allowing him to fulfill his end.
Wow. That's so incredibly powerful. What you're sharing now makes me also think of the idea of the wounded healer. And in reality, so many of us who are in the helping profession have faced multiple forms of adversity and trauma and fear and death and loss. And then on the other end, we also have been able to achieve healing and to grow and to thrive and to demonstrate our resilience. And what you're sharing now just reminds me of the fact that all of us kind of have both of these things in our narratives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as therapists, of course, we're human too. And we've had our own life experiences. I think it really makes a difference working with people to have had our own life experiences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So let's shift gears for a moment. So can you share a few important positive moments or turning points in your narrative?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot that I could say to this question, lots of different important moments. A couple that come up first, I guess specifically around shifting my attention to trauma. I started out in the addiction treatment world, working in inpatient, while also working in the prison system. Mm. So when I was in graduate school, I did an internship where I worked with mostly men who had been sentenced to life without parole for murder charges as juveniles. Mm. So I did a lot of advocacy work and spent a lot of time working within the prison system and the court systems, which I just found so exhausting and draining and painful. And I was noticing that so many, really all of the clients that I worked with prior to their offense that landed them in prison, they all had really significant trauma, loss, neglect, poverty, collective traumas often too, that just weren't being considered, weren't being addressed. And I started to see how trauma really impacted behavior later in life. And I was seeing the same thing in the addiction treatment world, where we have many clients who would, you know, come to treatment, go through their detox, you know, start to turn themselves around and really become a different person, and discharge from our program and 3 months later end up back in the program again. And we started to notice as a treatment team is that most of the clients who were kind of designated as chronic relapsers, they all had really unresolved trauma and loss that nobody was addressing across the treatment continuum. The inpatient centers were saying, you're an inpatient, you're just here to stabilize and detox, and we're not going to touch any of the trauma. We'll refer you to an IOP, an intensive outpatient program, and you can work on the trauma there. But then the client would get there and the IOP counselor would say, you're in transition. We're just going to stabilize you and transition you to an outpatient counselor. And that would do your trauma work. And it didn't seem like clients were making it there. Their trauma, their loss was being triggered. And oftentimes they were, again, self-medicating and ending up back in treatment. So I really
started. And then it sounds like treatment wasn't actually including getting to the root of the trauma either, or the root of what may have spurred on some of the addictive behaviors.
Exactly. Yeah. It seemed like a lot of the focus was on symptom reduction, stabilizing. There wasn't enough, in my judgment, enough exploration of, you know, what was going on that led to you picking up a substance or alcohol. Like, why did you feel a need to, you know, use heroin, a powerful opiate, to numb yourself? What were you numbing? Or, you know, alcohol being a central nervous system depressant, why did you feel the, why was your nervous system so overactive that you needed to calm it down? Kind of asking some of these other questions. So I really feel lucky in that I've had the opportunity to really help develop and expand the trauma services at the treatment center that I work at, where we really do focus on not just the symptoms of the addiction, but also the underlying causes. So this was one of the kind of important moments for me, is seeing this underlying thread of trauma in the patients I was working with struggling with addiction, with the guys I was working with in the prison system, and also on a larger scale in my social activism, where it seemed like just about every social injustice could be framed through the lens of trauma and collective trauma. So it just made sense to me that, like, this trauma thing plays a big role in just about every social or emotional issue. And we should be talking about it more. I mean, some other important moments or turning points in my story. Another more personal one is traveling. Before I got married, which again was another important turning point in my story. I used to just grab a backpack and go. I got really creative and skillful at finding the cheapest way to travel. And I would find like a ridiculously cheap flight to a country I've never been to, you know, that where I don't even speak other languages and don't know anybody there. I would go spend a week by myself in Mexico and explore, or I would go to, I did a big trip when I graduated with my bachelor's, circling the Mediterranean, kind of exploring some of my ancestry in Europe, and then going to the Middle East through Israel and Palestine and Jordan and Egypt and other parts of North Africa. And my traveling, I feel like my traveling really helped me grow as a human and as a therapist, in that it challenged me to learn about other cultures, other religions, about world history, politics. And it was really a spiritual and existential experience for me. It challenged me to get to know myself better. It really forced me to learn how to trust myself and listen to my body, and to develop trust in the goodness of strangers, no matter who they were.
Mm. Was it scary at all?
There were definitely scary moments. Mm-hmm. I think just about all of the scary moments I had were misunderstandings.
Mm.
Where I thought people were yelling at me in Arabic or a different language. And I started to get defensive. And then, somebody translated for me and told me they were just excited I was there and were trying to teach parts of the language or culture.
Mm.
One of my favorite travel stories and probably most powerful travel story I have, the first time I went to the Middle East, my family, of course, was really scared for me. But I had this really powerful, existential pull to the Middle East. And I was really curious about Islam and learning more. I had been studying Arabic for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, what was in the news a lot was about the Bedouin tribes that were kidnapping Western tourists. So my biggest fear and my family's biggest fear was me being kidnapped while I was over there. And through this really strange series of coincidences, I met this British businessman in Istanbul, and we had tea together, and I told him I was going to Jordan, the country Jordan, and he told me that 30 years ago, he used to live and work there and had lost contact with his friends there, and he wanted me to try to reconnect him with his friends. So I kind of was amused by this idea and, entertained it, took his contact information and the name of his friend.
Mm-hmm.
Weeks later, I was in Wadi Musa in Jordan, and I asked someone if they knew Ali Khalaf was his friend's name.
Mm-hmm.
And just so happened, Ali Khalaf was now the chief of the Bedouin tribe in that.
Wow.
So this guy takes me to the chief of the Bedouin tribe in Wadi Musa, and there's all these Jordanian military officers there, and they're all sipping hot tea, chain smoking cigarettes. And
mm-hmm.
I'm like a 21-year-old American by myself there, wearing mm-hmm. Air Force Ones and my cargo short, and trying to explain myself. And I gave him the British businessman's phone number, mm-hmm. and he calls him and starts crying on the phone.
Wow.
And it dawned upon me that through this strange series of synchronicities, I had reconnected this old friendship.
Mm.
And the chief made me the special guest for the weekend that I was there.
You can't make this stuff up.
I know, right? That's just one example of the really beautiful things that have happened. I find it to be a metaphor for showing up and walking through fear, whether it's out in the world or internally,
mm-hmm.
and exploring kind of those places, again, out in the world or those places within myself that I'm afraid to go, that there's often really beautiful, unexpected, spontaneous things that happen when we lean into that.
I was going to ask you if you could repeat that, but then I remembered that this is on recording, so I can rewind it when I listen to it again.
Yeah.
That was really powerful.
Thanks. Yeah.
Where do you see yourself in the future?
Yeah. So kind of just going back to the other question with another kind of powerful moment, which will tie into this question too. Mm-hmm. Back in 2016, I had the opportunity to meet the co-founder of Psychodrama, Zirka Moreno, just before she died. When I met her, she was in a coma. She was 99 years old just outside Washington, D.C. And my Psychodrama trainer at the time took me there to meet her, and we kind of acted as if she could hear us. I don't know if she could or couldn't. But when I introduced myself to her, she sat up on the bed and opened her eyes. And it was such a shock for all of us because she had been unresponsive in a coma. And she just opened her eyes, and her and I looked at each other for a moment, and then she laid back down and didn't really move much throughout the rest of the time we were there. But it was this deeply profound moment for me around being seen and encountering someone that I had read so much about and looked up to. And in that moment, this commitment just came out of my mouth that I committed to helping to carry Psychodrama to the next generation. I think in our Psychodrama community, there was some fear that it had really lost its popularity, and people weren't talking about it, weren't practicing it, weren't training in it as much as they used to. And there was some fear that the model might slowly wither away and die when the co-founder passed away. So a large part of what I do in the world is about trying to honor this commitment to Zirka around really trying to introduce new people and young people to Psychodrama through my teaching, training, presenting, even through this podcast. I realized that in order to reach the next generation, I really need to help get Psychodrama into academia. It's funny that in the U.S., you could go through an entire psychology or social work master's program and not hear Psychodrama mentioned once.
Right.
Whereas internationally, on most other continents, you could get a PhD in Psychodrama or a master's degree in Psychodrama. It's considered an evidence-based practice in Europe and in other countries. Whereas here in the U.S., it's really been marginalized, especially in academia. There's lots of reasons for that I won't get into.
I was just going to ask, but I can leave that alone. I was going to ask, why do you think that is?
Now I could talk about it if you'd like.
Sure.
I think some of it is about the founder, Jacob Moreno. So Moreno is actually the person who coined the term group therapy and group psychotherapy right here in Philadelphia. Although it's rare that his name is even mentioned in a group therapy class, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. His ideas were pretty radical. He was a mystic. He was a scientist. He was a therapist. I think of him as a social worker. Mm-hmm. By training, he was a psychiatrist. He had this vision that really came to him through his mystical experiences, this vision that he called societry, healing for society, or psychiatry for society. And his first attempt to create healing on a larger scale was using the theater in Vienna. And he would, try to create large change in larger audiences of people rather than just working one-on-one with clients. But his ideas really challenged the power dynamics within psychoanalysis, within traditional psychotherapy. He argued that in group therapy, everybody was a therapeutic agent. And this really ties in with what you and I know as social workers, you know, the idea of mutual aid, that everybody in the group, everybody in the community has inherent worth, has strengths, has valuable experience and the ability to support each other and heal each other. But Moreno really emphasized this to the point where he challenged the authority of the profession and argued that that the healing really needs to take place between group members rather than coming from the doctor or the expert. And he was really radical in a lot of the things that he did. His personality was pretty far out there as well, which I think limited his impact. He was very dramatic and eccentric and even self-identified himself as a megalomania. I think he sometimes had difficulty getting along with other professionals and had a number of rivals. I think some of the answer to the question too is about the politics of evidence-based practice.
That's a whole nother podcast series.
Absolutely. I mean, when we talk about group therapy, 75% of the published studies on group therapy are CBT studies. Like the majority of research grants are going to people who are studying CBT and cognitive behavioral therapies because they're easily manualized and replicated.
Right.
Whereas like psychodrama or art therapy, you know, things that are more expressive and creative and spontaneous, it's a lot harder to manualize those.
And right.
A lot of the expressive arts practitioners are much more action-based and less likely to be researchers, I found. I think this is some of the larger issue, although there is a large body of research that's emerging that's indicating that the experiential therapies are at least as effective as CBT for a large number of different mental health conditions. I just published a trauma-focused psychodrama study based on my work at Miramont that had some pretty promising results, especially when we compared them to the results for other CBT programs. We found a pretty significant decline in PTSD symptoms for the clients who participated in the study.
Wow.
And I think another kind of answer to your question about the absence of psychodrama in our culture is the individualism in the United States. A lot of other cultures that are more collective, community-based, just kind of more relationally oriented, more expressive, have really adopted and run with psychodrama. There's actually more psychodramatists in Brazil than in any other country in the world.
Oh, wow.
Psychodrama is very popular in Europe. In Asia, it's really becoming popular, Latin America. So in other places, it's really been more integrated into the culture and used outside of psychotherapy settings as well.
It sounds like you're playing a role in helping to emphasize the importance of psychodrama here.
Yeah, I like to think so. At least I like to think I'm playing a small part in advocating for change around this and contributing to the research base and educating folks about it. I just find that there's places that psychodrama and other experiential therapies allow us to go that just wouldn't be possible otherwise by sitting and talking in therapy.
Right.
I mean, in a psychodrama group, rather than just sitting and talking about somebody's trauma, we could act out connecting with the strengths that somebody needed to face their trauma. Or we could, I usually don't reenact someone's trauma scene because I don't think that's helpful and it's potentially re-traumatizing. But I often will help a client put into action a corrective emotional experience using psychodrama, where on the stage, they could have an experience that they wished for in real life or that they needed to have, but weren't able to experience. And I think, you know, what we're learning about neurobiology is that throughout the entire lifespan, somebody's brain continues to change and adapt based on experiences that they have.
Right.
And in the co-creation of a psychodrama scene, although it's surplus reality, it's not literally happening, everybody's acting as if it's real. And I really believe that it changes the brain in a way that the real life experience would have, that it creates change, not just psychologically, but also neurobiologically.
And neurobiology is so complicated. We wouldn't be able to like capture fully the complexities of neuroscience and its connection to trauma. But this is a really interesting thought that even thinking about a situation differently or imagining a different outcome, that could possibly create new connections in the brain. That's really exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I like to think of myself as a student in neuroscience. There's so much that I don't know about it, but I think I know a thing or two about it. Mm-hmm. And there's always changing research that's coming out. I mean, I think it's been really interesting the past few decades here, the neurobiology of trauma research specifically.
Right.
In some research, they found that when we ask a client to remember a trauma story, a memory, and we take a scan of the brain, the right hemisphere of the brain is overactive and the left hemisphere of the brain is a whole lot less active. And more precisely, the Broca's area, which is the language and speech center of the brain, is completely offline. So if we're doing trauma therapy with a client and relying on words or language for expression, for communication, and for intervention, we're going to be really limited when working with trauma.
Right.
You know, as is becoming apparent, trauma really impacts us at levels in the body and brain below consciousness and below words. It really impacts the nervous system. And so I feel like we really need to be including the body and other parts of the brain in our interventions in order to most be helpful for clients.
Absolutely. So do you see yourself expanding on the work that you're already doing?
Yeah. I'm just about to publish a book, which will be the first book integrating the fields of social work and psychodrama.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The idea kind of emerged from my doctorate dissertation,
okay,
which was on the same topic, although in my dissertation, I focused on creating a MSW curriculum, a course that would teach social work with groups and psychodrama as an integrated approach. So this is kind of meant to be the textbook for it. And it's a mix of history, philosophy, theory, and then there's sections on practice with individuals, with groups, and with community. And one chapter on using psychodrama and experiential work as a teaching method and supervision approach.
It sounds amazing.
Yeah, thanks. I'll have to get you a copy when it comes out.
Yes, please. And where can people find more information about the book?
So the book hasn't been announced yet, although it should be announced pretty soon here. Maybe by the time that the podcast is released, it'll be announced.
Okay.
but you can find information about my publications on my website.
Okay.
Which is phoenixtraumacenter.com. And there's a page with some more of my background and links to my different projects and publications.
So it really sounds great. I'm sitting here smiling because I'm excited to see and learn from what it is that you've written and what you're contributing to the field.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I've been thinking a lot lately just about, and I'm sure you can relate with this too, based on all the work you do, how as professionals who are working with, I mean, you and I are sometimes working in academic spaces, sometimes working and training clinicians or future clinicians, mm-hmm. and at other times working with community members or clients. Mm-hmm. And just how, based on the context and the space that we're in, we're like forced to be multilingual.
Right.
Like if I'm speaking to researchers, I'm talking with one type of language. If I'm communicating with therapists, I'm speaking a slightly different language. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I'm working with clients or community members, I'm describing concepts in different ways.
Right. So
the book is more focused on educating clinicians and researchers, although there are also a number of free resources on my website that I specifically wrote for community members and clients.
Sounds great. I'm always emphasizing that to my students too, that we have to be able to be conversant in multiple languages. And don't take the language of research and qualitative and quantitative studies when you're going and trying to connect with a client, with a child, with a teenager. Figure out how to talk like a regular person, but also identify ways that you can incorporate that language. You're going to have to know that fancy language when you're writing up a proposal, or when you are engaging in research, or when you're trying to justify your idea or why something is important to a funder. But it's absolutely, like, I just want to put an exclamation point next to next to what you were mentioning, because I also advocate for that as well. Be conversant in multiple languages. And that's part of what we have to do as social workers, as advocates, and in our work as people who are trauma informed, because the language is going to be different. The manner of communicating is going to be different depending on the population that you're trying to connect with.
Yeah, absolutely. I like to think of it as meeting the person where they're at, regardless of who that person is in front of me or that group in front of me.
Right. So are there any other resources that you would recommend to listeners?
Yeah, there's lots of different resources I could recommend. Some of the psychodrama stuff that I talked about, just by its nature, because it's so experiential and three-dimensional, I'm not going to be able to fully explain it to anybody through words. So if you're curious about that, I encourage you to seek out a psychodrama group. For my own process, I found any kind of mutual aid support group to be really important. There's some other personal growth processes I could recommend that really transformed my own experience in the world. Things like taking daily inventory, journaling, doing, really simple visioning processes for the future, creating like a concrete image of, what kind of man do I want to be in the world? Mm-hmm. And what does that actually look like in different areas of my life? I kind of frame that through Maslow's work of self-actualization and holding myself accountable to my vision. Mm-hmm. In terms of video resources, there's a ton of stuff out there, especially with YouTube and with podcasts, of course. Mm-hmm. Kind of in terms of larger societal, political, social issues, some of my favorite people to listen to are Cornel West and Anthony Anaxagoras, who's a lesser known poet, spoken word artist from the UK. I just find that both of them, they're talking about politics and social issues, but I feel like they really approach it from an existential, spiritual, humanistic approach, which I just really appreciate. Mm. I find that it kind of transcends some of the rhetoric that we normally use when we're talking about politics or social issues, and really frames it, human to human, which which I really appreciate.
That's important.
There's a ton of books that I could recommend. I'm a big fan of Rumi and Khalil Gibran, the poets. Some of my favorite books that have kind of expanded my own perception of the world include Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse, Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, The Way of the Peaceful Warrior. And then there's a number of professional books I could recommend as well. I'm a big fan of Tian Dayton's books on psychodrama. She has a number of books about addiction, about trauma, and psychodrama, some of which are written for clients. Her most recent book being The Soulful Journey of Recovery, which I recommend to a lot of my clients. Mm-hmm. And then some of her books for professionals. My favorite is the book called The Living Stage. And then if you're also interested in psychodrama, there's another book that I find to be the most comprehensive overview of Moreno's theory, philosophy, and history. It's a book by John Nolte. And if I can remember the title correctly, I believe it's The Methods, Philosophy, and Theory of Jacob Moreno, the Man Who Tried to Become God, which is kind of a spinoff on Moreno's existential philosophy. He argued that every human being was God, that every human being had the power to create and co-create. Every human being had agency in the world. Every human being was full of worthiness and dignity and strengths that we should emphasize, rather than looking at clients through a pathologizing lens like the medical model. So those are some of my favorite books, some, you know, for my professional self and others for my personal self.
I don't know how you have time to read either. Just after you mentioned all the different things that you're doing, researching, writing books, and just engaging in all this important work.
Well, one thing that really helped was when I was a young adult and was really, I mean, I'm still a young adult, but when I was in my, you know, early 20s, I spent a lot of time challenging everything I thought I knew about the world and really considering how I wanted to live my life. After having some near-death experiences, it really challenged me to spend my time wisely. And I decided to get rid of television and not to engage in pop culture. I mean, I went like 7 or 10 years without a television, which,
wow,
you know, gives you an incredible amount of additional time in your life.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I got married that I had to compromise and we got a television again.
Okay. Okay. Is there anything else that you want to share with our audience?
I think just coming back and reiterating the piece I was just talking about around everybody being inherently good and divine and godlike, whatever language you want to use based on, you know, your spiritual beliefs or existential beliefs. One thing that was transformative for me in my own personal and professional development was first seeing the goodness in other people and in my clients, even in the guys that I worked with who were in prison doing life without parole, being able to see the inherent goodness within them and to celebrate that. Mm-hmm. And after I had seen it regularly in other people and looked for it, it challenged me to also see it in myself, to really own my own strengths and goodness rather than downplaying them or, you know, trying to be smaller than I am. I mean, a lot of kind of that work happened before my professional studies. And when I learned about Marina's philosophy, it just articulated something that I knew to be true based on my experience in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think the important thing is just to affirm for anyone that's listening, to affirm for myself again, because I always need to remind myself mm-hmm. too, that within every person is the capacity for goodness. It exists within every person, no matter how traumatized somebody might be, no matter how addicted somebody might be, no matter what somebody may have done in the past, no matter what someone's behavior may have been. I truly believe that everybody within them has the capacity for goodness, and that when we treat people from that stance, that it creates a role demand and a role reciprocity for them to express that goodness too. Mm-hmm. So I think that's like the most important takeaway for me professionally and personally. I often think of my work at its core, whether I'm with clients, students, or trainees, as helping people remember their goodness. Mm-hmm. And it ties in with the professional philosophy that I work from. And it ties in with, you know, just my experience in the world. There's a lot more I could say about it. But I hope that was clear.
Oh, it was very clear. And really inspirational and powerful. And I think that it will carry a lot of meaning to a lot of listeners. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your vulnerability, for the resources that you shared, and also for talking to us about your part of your professional and your personal journey.
Thanks, Megan. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on the podcast and to share some of what I learned personally and professionally.
Thank you for listening to Real Stories. The resources referenced by today's guest speaker will be included in the episode description. For more information about me, Dr. Megan Corrado, and my work with the Stories Trauma Narrative Intervention, please visit my website, www.storiesguide.com. Also, feel free to follow my Stories social media pages on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Remember that for every story of trauma and adversity, there is always a story of strength and resilience.